Hello, Capital Region. Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Dan Platt.
And I'm Justin Romero. Tonight, Mark Dunley talks with Bob Cohen, Policy Director of Citizen Action, about the plans for the Working Families Party.
Then, Elizabeth Press talks with Barbara Smith, who just published her fourth op-ed on white supremacy called "White People Now Realize That White Supremacy is Coming for Them."
And later on, we have our weekly segment, Triple E. This week, H-Boss Jr. talks with Rosiah Coleman about STEM, mentors, and her startup business, and her plans for college.
After that, HMM correspondent Corrine Carey spoke with Steve Greenberg, a pollster with Siena, about the latest poll results he has.
Finally, Assemblyman John McDonald shares his reaction to Governor Cuomo's State of the State address and talks about COVID-19, the environment, New York industry, and more with Cynthia Poehler. But first, some headlines.
While ruling in favor of New York's ban on plastic bags, a judge in a highly unusual move ordered the state to pay the attorney fees of the plastic industry, which sued against the law. The judge said the DEC had repeatedly issued confusing rules to implement the law. The judge ruled against DEC's efforts to allow thicker plastic bags to be used in violation of the law. Now Cuomo is trying to use the budget to change the law to allow such bags.
Rensselaer County announced Wednesday night the death of a 93-year-old woman at the county-operated Van Rensselaer Manor for coronavirus. It was the fourth death at the facility. The Troy Center of Rehabilitation and Nursing in Troy also had an 85-year-old female resident die from coronavirus, bringing the total deaths in the county from COVID to 112.
The Times Union reports that after three consecutive days of new daily positive cases of COVID-19 hovering below 200, the number shot back up Thursday with 279 new cases in Albany County. There have been more than 750 deaths in the capital region overall from COVID.
The Gazette reports that Schenectady school officials say a 20% state aid cut is still possible, even after the governor appears to drop the threat. School board members noted that the governor's budget proposals were heavily reliant on the federal aid, including some aid that has not yet been approved by Congress. The district has laid off 400 teachers and staff.
The Schenectady Civilian Police Review Board, still in Schenectady, is recommending it have expanded powers and more formal structure as the city works on plans to comply with the state mandate to review and reform policing. The Gazette reports that the board is asking for the ability to review police body cam footage and recorded phone conversations when it investigates complaints about police misconduct. They also request to have better training for reviewer members and extending the deadline for filing a complaint from 45 days to 6 months, and to publicly announce the meetings of the board. The board also was in favor by a 4-3 split vote of having access to personal information on the officers the board is investigating, who are now currently anonymous. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine coming to you from the Schenectady for the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, email us at hmmmediasanctuary.org or follow us on Instagram or Twitter at Media Sanctuary and on Facebook at facebook.com/mediasanctuary.
Now let's talk about taxing the rich, climate, and the carbon polluter penalty, as our first interview will be touching the mind of Bob Cohen, Policy Director of Citizen Action of New York. Here is Mark Dunley with the story.
We're talking with Bob Cohen, Policy Director at Citizen Action of New York and also a State Committee member For the Working Families Party from Rensselaer County. We're mainly talking about the Working Family Party today, which has been in the news a little bit in Rensselaer County because, once again, the Republicans are trying to infiltrate to control other party ballot lines. If people are interested, we did an interview last week with Phil Markham that you can check out. But, you know, Bob, you know, it's a brand new year. New president. What are some of the Working Families Party's goals for 2021?
So thanks for having me, Mark. So obviously on a national level, we're having this interview about 2 hours before the Biden's inaugural. It's a real opportunity for progressives in New York State and nationally to begin to make some progress, as well as getting rid of that human nightmare we've been living through for the last 4 years. And with the Democratic control of both houses of the state legislature, we have an opportunity to do things on a number of areas. What I would say initially would come to mind are taxation of the wealthy. That's not just the right thing to do, but it's a means for us to address the incredibly urgent needs of the pandemic, but also the recession that is a result of the pandemic. There's a lot we want to do in areas like criminal justice reform, marijuana reform, and what I work on personally for Citizen Action the most, climate, addressing the climate crisis. So there's a whole list of things we want to do.
Now, the governor earlier this week, somewhat came out with his budget. It was an unusual in that he was very late in getting on his budget bills. And he seems to be taking two revenue approaches. Here's my budget. If I get, I forget the exact amount, $15 billion from, you know, Biden and the new Congress. And if I get less than that, here are all the massive cuts. But he still does not seem to be really committed to the tax the rich proposals. I think he said, well, if I get the least amount from the federal government, I'll give a couple extra percentage points to people making above $500,000. What is the Working Families Party trying to get the state legislature to do with raising the taxes on wealthy?
Right. So one thing on the governor is just to add to what you said is the governor for years has been reluctant to be polite to do what is the right thing from working families and so many of our allies' perspective, which is you know, establish fair taxation and tax the people who have the billionaires in New York State, predominantly New York City, who have not only shouldn't be having that kind of wealth, but also have benefited even more in recent years, decades, and particularly with the Trump tax cuts. So what we have put together a coalition, and when I say we, I mean Working Families and a number of its organizational allies, including my organization, Citizen Action, put together this coalition that this year is focusing on five pieces of priority legislation that are all focused on taxing the wealthiest New Yorkers and the corporations. I can go through them if you want, but collectively, we expect or project that these bills will raise $50 billion a year on a state budget that I think is probably, I just looked, somewhere in the neighborhood of $180, $190 billion. That's a huge amount of money. So the headline here is, while we certainly want money from the federal government, and that's the right thing to do, that is should not be an excuse to address the most urgent needs of New Yorkers in this crisis.
Now, I believe in addition to the $50 billion package, the Working Families Party and New York Renews, which you're, you know, part of, have also been promoting a polluter penalty. Some would call it a carbon tax, but the idea that we should, require those who pollute our air, our lungs, our healthcare system to pay for the damages they cause. How is that progressing? And what's the exact name of the bill?
So the exact name of the bill, sometimes we do it in shorthand, CICA, but it's the Climate and Community Investment Act. And that's a proposal that we've been working on for a long time. It's a really complex proposal. And we most recently have submitted the current version to our prospective legislative sponsors who are looking at it now. So we, I don't want to like speak for the sponsors, but we think that the bill should pop up in the next few weeks and time to be considered next session. And if you want, Mark, I could go in a little bit more detail.
Well, I believe you're now talking about trying to raise about $15 billion or so annually, and you're going to set the initial price for the carbon tax at maybe $50, $55 a ton?
Yes, $55. In the latest version of the bill, it's $55. It was previously lower, and we reevaluated based on what some other entities have been doing throughout the nation. But yes, that's right. And I think the important thing, and again, I could go through it more if you'd like, but one thing that the premise of our bill, besides just, we're not just about raising the $15 billion. We want to use the $15 billion to transform New York's economy to a renewable energy economy. That's the idea. The climate law that was passed in 2019 is important because it reduces greenhouse gases, but to get to the next step, which is transforming New York's economy to renewables, we need to jumpstart private industry does. There'll be a role for private industry, but so many advances, good and bad, in our history have been because of government action jumpstarting those steps.
Now, 2021, being an odd number year, is when we had the local races, as you know, for city councils and mayors and county governments. You know, in the Capital District, you know, what are some of the, you know, the broad type of plans that the Working Families Party, you know, campaigns they hope to put together for this November?
So I'm going to talk in really general terms, because quite honestly, we're having our first interviews this weekend. And I myself need to learn, you know, who has submitted applications for us. But certainly among the things that I'm aware of, I mean, there are local races throughout the state, but in the Capital District, one of the hot races is a Rensselaer County executive. There's an exciting candidate that is coming to us for county executive. I believe there are legislative races. You know, there's also town races throughout all of the Capital District, and we'll have to see who is coming to us for endorsement. And we do encourage people. It's a little late in our process, but, you know, we're at least theoretically, if you came to us in the next day or so, we're at least open to considering other endorsements as well.
Now, we only have about a minute. Been talking with Bob Cohen, the Citizen Action Working Families Party. You know, the governor at his State of the State last week made some bold statements about the need to move harder and faster on climate. He also admitted, somewhat surprisingly, that New York has consistently failed to meet its prior goals with respect to climate action. In 45 seconds, what can the average person at this point try to do to push you know, our state government to accomplish the goals they have laid out on climate?
So there's a number of things. I'll go really quick, but I think the most important thing you could be doing is calling. It's a little hard now with the governor, but the calling, emailing, and contacting legislators and the governor and DEC and NYSERDA, the two entities that'll be leading, you know, the climate transformation and urging them to take aggressive actions on climate, particularly not to fall for some of the corporate supported moves like renewable natural gas that will not get us to real climate transformation. And I would urge you people to visit the nyrenews.org webpage for specific details on what we're working on. And that's the coalition that Citizen Action and Working Families Party are part of.
Well, thank you, Bob Cohen, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
An exciting piece from Mark, where we got to see some of the goals from Citizen Action of New York for the new year.
Next, Hudson Mohawk magazine producer Elizabeth Press speaks with Barbara Smith about her most recent article, her larger series, and her reaction to the recent events at the Senate.
Next, I am joined by author and scholar Barbara Smith. She has been active in movements for social, racial, and economic justice since the 1960s. Her new piece in the Boston Globe is called "White People Now Realize White Supremacy is Coming for Them." Barbara Smith, thanks for joining us again on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you.
And just to get started, I just wanted to hear your reaction to the events on January 6th attack on the Capitol.
Besides the shock, but not surprise, because people have been using that phrase a lot during this terrible administration, shocked, but not surprised, because of course, this individual is capable of anything, as low as you think it's possible to go. I was struck by the fact that people were saying that this kind of mob violence, this kind of un-American, seditious behavior was just completely out of character for the United States. And I'm thinking, the first thing I think of is like, have you ever heard of lynch mobs? Because everything that was being said about the attack on the Capitol could be said about the more than 4,000 lynchings that occurred in the United States starting in the post-Civil War period and going well into the mid-20th century. So that was one of my thoughts, that I think that as a Black person, an African-American, I think I see what happened quite differently, because I know that kind of terrorism has been visited on my community from time out of mind.
Since George Floyd was murdered, you have written a series of 4 articles on white supremacy. If you look at this series as a whole, what should our audience know about racism and the system of white supremacy?
One of the things that I'd like to point out is that at the end of the first article, I talk about how it was likely that even though there was so much focus on what was going on racially after George Floyd was lynched, and also with Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, et cetera, there was a lot of more focus because of those egregious murders, that even so, that what would eventually happen is that the establishment would just do the Band-Aids performative, not really change anything. But I also warned, this was the last sentence of that article written in June, was that if the nation did not address white supremacy, that it would face continued police brutality, vigilante violence, and would move in the direction and be closer to becoming a failed state. And that's exactly where we are now. That analysis that I included in that first piece, it came to pass. And that was one of the motivations I had for writing the one that was just published. I knew that without addressing and eradicating white supremacy, we were on a very dark path to being a failed state, because there were definitely signs and indications of that. When you had the video of a man being murdered on screen, that the whole world gets to observe and see, you're a failed state. That's the kind of thing that's supposed to happen in those other countries, right? The terrorism, etc. And there it is. It's America. Well, my primary goal when I wrote the first one, which is titled "The Problem is White Supremacy," is to get people to begin to think about the fact that this is a system. It is a system of oppression. It is coordinated. It is embedded. It is based in a power structure. It is violent. It is vicious. And it has at least one purpose, more than one. But one of its major purposes is to make sure that white people are advantaged and that people of color are not. And that works out economically. So it's not just not liking people of color. specifically Black people, but of course, all people of color, because we all pay that price for living in a white supremacist nation. It's not just about not liking us or feeling superior to us. It's because they're economic gains. And that's what I wanted people to understand. And that particularly in relationship to the very, very intense conversation about racism and policing, because I think there are people to this day, in fact, I know there are people to this day because I see them on my TV who are saying that if we just get the police to do better and not to be so incredibly violent in how they treat people of color who live in the United States, if we can just get them to do better, then everything's solved. Now, with the attack on the Capitol, the conversation has shifted to if we can just get these white supremacist organized groups under control, then everything will be solved. But it's always the wrong answer. That's neither one of those things, getting the police to reform, or on the other hand, getting the white gangs, the white racist gangs to reform. We're still going to have white supremacy as a system.
Thank you for that. And you titled the piece, or the piece is titled, and you talk about, you write, white people realize white supremacy is coming for them. Can you explain the sentence?
I like that sentence because it says very succinctly that now that white people realize that white supremacy can be dangerous even to them, they are paying more attention to it and they're actually talking about it, but they're not talking about it as a system. They're talking about it as fringe hate groups that are armed. That's how they're seeing it now. And I guess it's baby steps, but I've always known that white supremacy was not good for white people either. But now it's just very crystal clear because they were gunning for white people. Their worldview meant that certain white people were traitorous to them. But of course, there was also the other myth that a certain individual had won the election. What a coincidence that the people who believed that that certain individual had won the election were wearing pro-Holocaust t-shirts and carrying Confederate flags. What a coincidence.
Do you want to go into that a little bit more?
The point I'm making is that there's a lot of focus nowadays on this lie, the big lie that the individual got people to believe and that he incited them with the big lie because he was telling that lie for months on end, even before the election, that if he did not win, that would show that the election was stolen and that it was rigged. So people are focusing on that, but they're not focusing on why are certain people disposed to believing that lie. I made the point in the new op-ed that that white supremacy is a driver for the success of that person's presidency. So it's no coincidence then that the people who ran into the Capitol and were responsible for the deaths of five other human beings, it's no surprise that they have those kind of views. And I also make the point that that is a very fundamental base of 45's deep appeal. He was promising to those 74 million people who voted for him, more people voted for him this time than they did in 2016. What does that tell you? He is providing something to them. He is offering something to them that they dearly, dearly lust after. And what that is unbridled, free reign, white supremacy. They are concerned, and that's a nice word, they're incensed that soon they will no longer be the majority population by numbers in the United States. Doesn't mean that they're not going to have white skin privilege and that white supremacy isn't going to continue long after those numerical proportions changed. But they also had to deal with the great insult of a Black president, and they have to deal with the insult of people of color being assertive about our rights, as was so very vividly shown by the massive demonstrations that happened after George Floyd's lynching. So they're just aggrieved. They're aggrieved. They want this to be a white man's country, and that's what he was selling them. That's what he was offering to them. I think also it's important to know about white supremacy and white racism, that looking at the 74 million people who voted for the former president, that I'm not saying that all 74 million people are card-carrying white supremacists, those who voted for him, but I am saying that they're all right with white supremacy because he is a white supremacist. They are all right with where he's coming from, the babies in the cages and being separated from the parents and the SHIT whole countries, all of the things that he has put out there. He has like an encyclopedia of like these racist attacks, and the 74 million people who voted for him and the 87% of Republicans today, according to recent polling, who have no problems with what he has done and do not hold him accountable for that attack on the Capitol, that shows that we have a big problem.
That was Hudson Mohawk's very own Elizabeth Press interviewing Barbara Smith, giving us an insight on what she thinks of the events that occurred at the Capitol on January 6th. Find a longer version of this interview on our website.
For those just tuning in, I'm Dan Platt.
And I'm Justin Romero. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, comments, or a sour bone to pick, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Triple E's host, H. Bosch Jr., as part of the 518 Shining Stars segment, speaks with 15-year-old Raelzan Coleman about STEM, mentors, and her startup business, and her plans for college. This is part one of a two-part segment.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another segment of the show, Triple E's Education, Empowerment, Entrepreneurship. This is part one of a two-part segment highlighting the 518 Rising Stars. Today's rising star guest is Raziya Coleman, STEM honor student and entrepreneur. Welcome to the show, Raziya.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good.
Good, good. Okay, so I'm going to go right into my questions for you. So tell me, how old are you?
I am 15 years old.
Okay, and what grade are you in?
I'm in 10th grade.
Okay, and where do you go to school?
I go to school at Albany High School.
Oh, okay. And how many brothers and sisters?
I have two brothers.
Two brothers. Okay. All right. Okay. I guess some of them left, and I heard you had six. But anyway, moving right along. So I understand you're an honor student, and that's really interested in the STEM science. Tell me what STEM is and why you're so interested in that.
STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. I'm interested in STEM because I like exploring the different pathways of science, like forensics and chemistry. And I like using different types of learning pathways to learn different things in life.
Okay. So what is your favorite STEM subject and why?
Chemistry. I like chemistry because even though we don't see it, we can't see it with our eyes, it's still going on throughout around us, and we're understanding the nuclears and the atomic levels of our world, and how does that impact our world simultaneously right now.
Wow. Ooh, that sounds really impressive. Wow. So you're a student. I'm sure other students want to know, how do you stay so busy and still maintain an A average with all your other activities you got going on? How do you do that?
You have to maintain a schedule and sit down and like be able to sit down in a calm space and be able to work without any distractions. You need to be able to set like a certain amount of time to like actually like sit down and dedicate yourself to learning. And like, don't push yourself too hard or you're gonna overwhelm yourself, and take time to do breaks with yourself and to actually have fun and be able to do the things you want to do, even though there's like a lot of work. You need to separate time for yourself.
That's good. It's really good too, to learn how to discipline yourself and set priorities. So tell me some of your favorite books you've read. Give me one or two, because I understand you're a real bookworm.
My favorite books that I read is Serafina and the Twisted Staff. And the book I'm reading now that I like is Julius Caesar.
Ooh, wow. Julius Caesar. Okay. And that's about the Roman Empire, right?
Yes. Okay.
Well, let's go back to that first book. What's that about? Because I know what Julius Caesar is about, because I live with a dictator. Anyway, go ahead.
So the first book,
you didn't think you was going to come on this show and not laugh, did you?
I've been reading this book. It's like a series of books about this girl named Serafina. I've been reading these books since like elementary school. I've always been caught up with there's four books. I always bought every book. I always been updating to see if there's any new, more books coming. So this was about this girl and how she is born. She does not know nothing about herself and how she's born in this like grand castle. However, her father is very poor, and her father found her in the woods one day and he just took her along with him. He works for this big fancy rich family, but they don't know that she lives in the basement. So one day while she's scavenging home, her father makes her like, not makes her, but helps her. She helps her father with his duties in the palace. And then one day she spots like this evil figure eating children, not eating children, but capturing children's souls in like this big cloak. And then ever since then, she's been wondering, who is that? And on the way, there's this, the rich family's nephew, his family has died in a fire back in home. So he moved to the palace to live with his family. So the boy and the girl became friends to figure out who is trying to capture all the children in the palace. And they fight together and they figure out who won it. It was one of the guests that stayed at the mansion.
Oh, wow. Tell me your favorite teacher in school, and what grade was that and why?
My favorite teacher was Mrs. Lane. She was my art teacher in middle school from 6th to 8th grade. She was my favorite teacher because she always empowered me and she never gave up on me, even when I wanted to give up on myself. And she always pushed me to do better, even when I knew I could do better, but she always pushed me to be the best version of myself.
Oh, wow. That's really great. That's great. So do you play any sports along with all your academic accomplishments?
I tried to do a sport once, but after that, no.
Okay. So what do you think about other students that are in the STEM? What is it? Now, explain what STEM is again for me.
Science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
Okay. So do you think that that's going to be the dominant field in the future as far as occupations, jobs, et cetera?
Yes, I personally think so, because as our world keeps advancing with new technologies, there's going to be more fields of opportunities that comes with that. So I think that field of STEM is going to be more broadly and opened up to many types of people.
Okay. I've always liked STEM too, but I'll be honest, I was a history major. I was a history buff. History was my favorite subject, but I think science is really, really important, especially today with the way the world is evolving. I think kids in school really need to know, along with knowing the basic R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, science is going to be really big in the near future. You now are a 518 rising star.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Okay, remember this. Dance like there's no one watching, sing like there's no one listening, love like you've never been hurt, and you better live like it's heaven on earth. Until next time, folks, don't hear about making a difference. You need to be about making a difference. This is Inez Bosch's baby boy and your overcoming adversity specialist, H. Bosch Jr., doing what I'm made to believe.
Listen in every week for another Triple E segment with H. Bosch Jr. as he continues to highlight our youth and future.
Siena College Research Institute conducts periodic polls on issues of the day and each MLK Jr. Day for the past decade. The Institute has asked New Yorkers how they feel about race relations in New York, along with their views on BLM and more. HMM correspondent Corinne Carey spoke with Steve Greenberg, a pollster of Siena, about his latest results and research.
Steve, Siena came out with some interesting numbers from the polling that you do. Can you tell us about them?
As Siena has done virtually every year for well over a decade now, came out with a poll asking New Yorkers their views on race, race relations, discriminations. It's our way of acknowledging and celebrating Martin Luther King Day. And what we find right now is that 31% of New Yorkers would describe race relations in this state as excellent or good, compared to 64% who describe them as only fair or poor. What to me, though, Corinne, is really surprising is not those numbers, because in fact, that's the exact same number we had when Siena last asked this question in June. And it's very comparable to what the number was this time last year on MLK Day in 2020, when it was 33 positive, 64 negative. To me, what's particularly surprising is that over the course of the last year, when there's been these national conversations about race and the criminal justice system and policing, and we have Black Lives Matter, and we've had protests in big cities and small cities and little towns all across the country this year. And the fact that the views of New Yorkers when it comes to race have not changed an iota in the last 6 months or in the last year.
How do you explain that?
I don't. I really don't. Two other interesting things, though. One is when we look at that number, we should understand that while there's a little bit of difference by race, there really isn't a significant difference by race. So for Black voters in New York, they are 27% positive towards race relations in the state, 71 negative. For white voters, it's 33-62. A little better, but not significantly. And again, we've seen that throughout. What's really other thing that to me is particularly interesting is that for the last 6 years, since 2015, these numbers on this question have been virtually the same. They go up a couple points one year, down a couple points another year. But the real difference was if we go back to MLK Day 2014, 7 years ago, at that time it was 47% positive, 51% negative. Still underwater, but significantly closer. A year later, on MLK Day 2015, it was almost identical to where it is today, 31-66. What happened between MLK Day 2014 and 2015? Eric Garner in Staten Island, Michael Brown in Ferguson. I think those two issues and the national conversation that occurred during the course of that year moved voters, Blacks and whites, so that we saw that change by 2015. Nothing that has happened over the last 6 years has moved these numbers significantly better or significantly worse. The other question that we haven't asked quite as long, but we've asked it now several times over the course of the last 5 or 6 years is, do you think minorities in New York, African Americans, Latinos, Asians, others, do you think that they experience discrimination here in New York State? 70% of New Yorkers say yes, 70-22. Back in June, it was 73-19. But every time we've asked this question, it has been between 2/3 and 3/4 of New Yorkers. There is a racial difference, but not huge. 90% of African American, 78% of Latino, and 65% of white voters say that racial minorities experience discrimination in New York. And similarly, 69% say that religious minorities, Jews, Muslims, Sikhs, others, face discrimination, 69 to 22 on that question. It's not getting better, it's not getting worse. But despite all the conversation, despite all the protests and march and discussions, very little has changed in the mind of New Yorkers, black or white, about the state of race relations or discrimination in this state.
Why is polling on this question important? What can these numbers tell us about ourselves, about what we need to do?
Poll is nothing more than a snapshot in time, but this is a snapshot we've taken now, at least annually, for more than a decade. And I think it's important that people understand how they, their community, their neighbors, their fellow New Yorkers feel about issues, particularly issues like this that mean so much to people. I mean, another question we've asked now for several years, have you personally been treated unfairly in the last year because of your race, your religion, your ethnicity, your gender, your orientation, your disability status, what have you? And almost a third, 32% of New Yorkers say yes, they have. A third of New Yorkers, almost. And we've seen that number consistently for the last several years. So when you have an issue where one out of every three fellow New Yorkers feels that they are treated unfairly because of who they are, what they feel, what they believe or don't believe, I think that's worth talking about. And it seems to me a day like Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday is a kind of nice day to talk about issues like this.
Yeah, if nothing else, it tells us how much work we still have yet to do, not only just about people's perceptions of the problem, but the problems that they're experiencing themselves.
Absolutely. And I should just quickly mention that we included in our favorable, unfavorable section when we ask about people and institutions, we included the Black Lives Matter movement and asked voters, do they have a favorable or unfavorable view of the BLM movement? 56% of New Yorkers view it favorably, 33% view it unfavorably. And again, we do see a racial difference, but the racial difference pales in comparison to the partisan difference. So on a question like this, 77% of New Yorkers have a favorable view of the Black Lives Matter movement. Independents, sort of divided, but by a small plurality, 44 to 40%, they have a favorable view of BLM. But Republicans, by a 62 to 27% margin, they have an unfavorable view of Black Lives Matter movement. And then we asked voters, do you think that the Black Lives Matter movement has had a positive impact, a negative impact, or no impact on America over the course of the last year? 48% of New Yorkers, a plurality, think BLM has had a positive impact on America. 32% think it's had a negative impact. 13% of New Yorkers say it's had no impact at all.
Oh, for all the effort that they put in to raising consciousness, 13% of people think it has no impact. Did the poll ask any questions that weren't related to race relations?
Well, our part one, which came out on King Day, only included that. Our part two, which came out on Tuesday, had a lot of other issues from elected officials and how they're doing, Cuomo, Trump, Biden, Pence, Harris, the legislature, etc., to some of the, you know, more substantive issues of where people are at on a variety of issues facing New York State right now. We asked voters, do you think that in terms of the pandemic, the worst is over or the worst is still to come? And by a 55 to 31% margin, New Yorkers said, the worst is still to come. And what's interesting to me on this one, Corinne, there are always questions that I never know how New Yorkers are going to feel. I can guess, but invariably I'm wrong. What I found surprising on this is we were just talking about the partisan differences on some of those racial issues. And I can show you a ton of different issue questions or favorability about people questions where there's a wide disparity between Democrats and Republicans. But on this question about the pandemic, 31% of Democrats, 32% of Republicans, 30% of independents say that the worst of the pandemic is over. So we found an issue that Democrats and Republicans can agree on.
Well, Steve, we're out of time for this segment, but I'd love to have you back. Would you be willing to come back and talk about what else you found with regard to the governor? And, you know, we're T-minus a couple of days and hours before we have a big change in administration. And I'd love to have you tell us what New Yorkers are thinking about the outgoing and the incoming president.
I would be happy to.
That was part one of a two-part interview with Steve Greenberg. The second segment focuses on how New Yorkers feel about certain political leaders and issues facing the New York State legislature in 2021.
Cynthia Pooler talks with Assemblyman John McDonald about COVID-19, the environment, New York industry, and his reaction to Governor Cuomo's State of the State address.
Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Cynthia Pooler from Focus on Albany, and my guest today is Assemblyman John McDonald. And Assemblyman McDonald will be talking and sharing his views on the governor's State of the State message. So I'm sure you listened or watched all four segments. What do you think? Give us a quick rundown.
Well, first of all, I will say this. It was completely different than what we've done in the past. Usually, a lot of pomp and circumstance, and the governor would go on and speak for an hour, hour and 20 minutes, hour 30 right. maybe at times. And then, as you know, Cynthia, because you're a regular down there at the Capitol, all the hoopla that would go on after with all the receptions and things. This year, completely different. Wherever you were, right. if you had internet access, you're able to watch it. And the governor actually had the opportunity to take a larger platform for 4 days in a row. And usually mm-hmm. about 30, 35 minutes each time, hit on some important themes, and we should talk about them. You know, obviously, okay. he made it very clear about the vaccination effort and how we need to be all rowing in the right direction on that aspect. Made it very clear that New York State has been not only with the amount of deaths lost impacted by COVID-19, but just as importantly in regards to the fact that we have been hurt economically and in many aspects, not just state budget, but families' budgets, local governments' budgets, the whole nine yards. And that's challenging to itself as well. So, you know, he's made it very clear. He's expecting, and we're praying, that Joe Biden is going to come true on what he's saying. I think the results of January 5th, which basically vaulted Chuck Schumer into the majority position, is extremely helpful. And as you know, last night, President-elect Biden laid out his concepts for the $1.9 billion economic relief package. So the governor took a good bet. Honestly, we were in a tough position, and hopefully, and I know we'll talk over the coming months, this will work out to New Yorkers benefit. I think the other exciting, and go ahead, Cynthia.
What did you hear that you thought was innovative and exciting?
Well, what's exciting is closer to home. The whole green energy component, you know, yes, it's important that we continue to focus on reaching our goals that we laid out in the Climate Change Protection Act, which I supported. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of talk about solar and the siting process. What is often lost in this discussion about renewable energy is getting it from point A to point B. And this has been something that governor after governor after governor after governor have kind of not really addressed, which is we need to build for the first time in 30 or 40 years new transmission devices to transmit this renewable energy. And that's been a very big Achilles heel in regards to our goals towards reaching renewable energy. What is truly most exciting back closer to home is the announcement of something that myself and Pat Fahey and Neil Breslin and Kathy Sheehan and Dan McCoy have been working together along with neighborhood folks like Carolyn McLaughlin and Willie White and Tom McPeters to see the siting of the first in the country wind manufacturing facility, wind turbine manufacturing facility in the Port of Albany. The Port of Albany, as you know, is in Albany, but also the port being proactive. 3 years ago, when this discussion of wind energy was coming up, purchased 80 acres of land over in Bethlehem, which is adjoining. It's right there at the port. The same, and there now we have been awarded. This has been a cited spot. The winner is going to invest over $330 million in building these significantly large manufacturing facilities that will just bring 500 construction jobs alone to the site. But just as importantly, if not more importantly, we are establishing a new career for many individuals who don't even know who it's going to be. It's going to be a good 300 to 500, and if not more, jobs, good middle class construction trade jobs in regards to the manufacturing facility. The labor trades, which we're great partners with, are very much involved. And what's great is that the contractor or the winning bidder, as part of their package, was smart. They are required, and they are required to fund this, to create a wind industry institute for job training. So think of those young men and young women that are either in high school trying to contemplate their next steps, or maybe those 20-somethings, even 30-somethings, that kind of haven't really figured out where they want to go or want to look in a different direction. We are going to have a training institute to teach them how to work in these facilities. And I think that's a credit to all of our local partners working together. I think it's a credit to the neighborhood who's saying, here in the South Bend, we think that this is an important aspect. And I can tell you, because I was involved in many of the negotiations and conversations, one of our biggest comments to Equinor and the other companies was, we want to make this something that not only the South End will benefit, but the Capital Region as well. And to create that next industry, it reminds me of when my grandfather, who's long passed, but, you know, back in the early 1900s, the railroad industry was his industry. That's what was made him be able to raise his family in the middle class. Mm-hmm. This wind industry is what's going to allow future families to grow up in the middle class and great opportunity. So to me, that is arguably the most exciting item that came out of the governor's State of the State address.
One thing that really sparked my interest when the governor was talking about how COVID changed everything and we are more dependent on technology than ever before. And, you know, a couple of years ago, there was a proposal in the Common Council in Albany for municipal internet. How do you feel about our increasing dependence on technology, and what do you think about municipal internet?
So, you know, it's interesting. You're talking about the digital divide. And when you talk about increased broadband investment, everyone thinks the North Country and cell towers. But the truth of the matter is that's important. But just as importantly is affordable access to families, particularly of low to moderate income. And that's where the governor talked about a couple different components. I want to mention both. Obviously, the one where income-qualified families would be able to have reliable, strong internet access at $15 a month, which is much more reasonable than what, you know, the average person's paying now, which is anywhere between $50 to $100 a month. Mm-hmm. And yes, you're right. He actually brought up the discussion and topic that I remember having 20 years ago when I was mayor of the city of Cohoes about municipal internet. And to be honest with you, I followed it very close because I was always intrigued by it because it really is a public utility. The question is the municipal government going to run it, or is the municipal government going to sponsor it and manage it? How is that going to look? Because let's face it, right now, yes, local governments run water and sewer. but they don't run power and light. They don't run gas and electricity. So mm-hmm. how do we get there is the question that's going to be important. I've always been intrigued by it. Chattanooga, Tennessee has always been the pioneer right. around the country. But you've mm-hmm. also seen cities like Philadelphia fail and fail miserably doing it too. So I think it's worth exploring. I don't know if it's for every community, but for communities, particularly those that are struggling with poverty, and, you know, Albany and Troy are the two highest, although my other three cities struggle with it in the 13 to 14%. In you know, Troy and Albany are usually 19 to 20, if not 22% poverty. Mm-hmm. If there's a way to help subsidize it, to provide low-cost, effective, if not free, internet, it's something we need to explore.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
That was Assemblyman John McDonald talking with HMM's Cynthia Pooler.
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Dan Platt.
And I'm Justin Romero. Our engineer is Sina Basidla Hickey. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get the dose on demand, though, our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments, suggestions, or to comment on our work, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org.
As a reminder, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers like ourselves. If you're interested in helping our radio effort, record a program, learn how to do radio and other such activities, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. No issue too small, no story worth overlooking. Or you can also join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m. by sending an email requesting an invitation link to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. That is the place to get involved. Until, or easiest way to get involved. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.